Happy Hump Day. It's Minnesota News on the NPR News Update for Wednesday, January 15th. I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up on the podcast, details of the agreement that ended the nearly 500-day Minnesota orchestra lockout, why the state's lieutenant governor is stepping aside, tanning beds may be harmful to your skin in the long term, the U looks to empower nurses, and a St. Paul landmark is closing its doors. First, a St. Paul teenager has been found guilty in a beating last summer that left a man with a severe brain injury. Tim Nelson has more.
Sundarian Butler was found guilty of first-degree assault and robbery for the August 4th beating. Ray Widstrand was reportedly passing by a fight outside an East Side party when he tried to intervene and was assaulted by a group of youths. Police said they found Widstrand's blood on Butler's shoe, an apparent indication he'd kicked Widstrand while he lay unconscious in the street. Widstrand has been left disabled by the assault and has needed assistance to walk during the trial. He also has difficulty talking because of the injuries he received in the beating. Four young men were charged in the assault. One was acquitted in November. Another pleaded guilty in October. Another youth, a 15-year-old, faces a hearing today on whether he'll be charged as an adult. Butler is scheduled to be sentenced in March. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
After a long, bitter fight, the Minnesota Orchestra lockout is over. Musicians and management reached agreement yesterday, and players return to work in 2 weeks. Ewan Kerr has our report.
Rumors of a settlement began swirling in mid-afternoon, but it wasn't until 6:15 that musician negotiator Tim Zavadil said the words many Minnesota Orchestra fans had waited to hear for months.
Today, the musicians ratified the proposal for a new collective bargaining agreement. That means that on February 1st, the musicians will look forward to going home at Orchestra Hall after a lockout that will have lasted 488 days.
Talks which began quietly a month ago as an attempt just to find a way out of months of deadlock blossomed into fully-fledged negotiations in the last 2 weeks. The musicians who stood before the press looked more tired than elated. They did not take as much of a pay cut as management once proposed, but over the 3 years of the contract, base pay will go down by 10%. They will also pay for more of their health benefits. Management negotiator Doug Kelly said his side is grateful to the musicians for recognizing the financial stress faced by the organization.
We have about a 15% concession across the board with salaries and benefits. That won't solve our deficit problem, but it will go a long way towards alleviating a lot of it.
Kelly says the contract also includes what he describes as a revolutionary idea for an orchestra, revenue sharing.
And if the endowment performs quite well over the next 3 years, we are prepared to share that with the musicians. And I believe that that's one of the first provisions for revenue sharing in an orchestra across the United States of America.
The compensation package will keep Minnesota in the top 10 U.S. orchestras in terms of pay, which the musicians said was very important to them. Management also reduced the number of work rule changes it had demanded. But musicians agreed to a number which will allow more flexibility for chamber concerts, holiday events, and longer performances. Under the deal, the number of musician positions in the orchestra remains at 95. However, the musicians agreed to allow management to keep a number of those positions open, with the upper limit of 84 in the ensemble during this contract. The settlement includes an agreement to present at least 20 weeks a year of classical concerts, after musicians raised concerns about the amount of non-classical programming. After the rancor of the past 15 months, Tim Zavadil was asked whether it was hard for the musicians to accept the deal when it finally came down to a vote.
No. I mean, we took care of the business that we needed to take care of, and we are going to work as hard as we can with the leadership to make sure that the orchestra thrives.
That leadership is going to change. Board Chair John Campbell, who was a lightning rod for anti-management criticism, was recently reappointed to his position until a settlement was reached. He'll move on in coming weeks. President and CEO Michael Hansen has also been the subject of scorn from musician supporters. Some have been calling for his firing for months. However, Zavadil says Henson's future had not come up during negotiations.
No discussions there.
Board negotiator Doug Kelly was also succinct in his response to questions about Henson.
Mr. Henson is still the CEO of the Minnesota Orchestra and will continue in that capacity.
There are also questions about the future involvement of Osmo Venska, who resigned as music director in October as the lockout dragged on and caused the cancellation of a series of concerts at Carnegie Hall. Tim Zavadil says he doesn't know if Venska will be back.
It will only make us stronger if Osmo returns. I really don't know. I don't know if it's possible.
Doug Kelly sidestepped the issue when asked, saying the board wanted to take one thing at a time.
Hiring a conductor and solving that issue is a thorny issue, and so we decided we'll get the contract settled now.
Then he said the board will deal with hiring a music director. When pressed whether Venska might be back, he responded, "It's possible, sure." Venska is in Helsinki at present. When contacted by NPR about the end of the lockout, he declined to comment, just as he has since he stepped down. Others have left the Minnesota Orchestra during the lockout. Many musicians have taken jobs elsewhere. When Zavadil was asked whether they might return now there is a settlement, he said it will be up to each individual to decide.
We hope to bring everybody back to the stage. But we can't answer for them.
And then there is the audience. The musicians have attracted a huge amount of support from enthusiastic audience members. Zavadil says it was important for the players, particularly when they wondered about keeping up the fight.
I think what we have learned throughout this process is there is a tremendous love for the organization as a whole in the community. The community really cherishes the orchestra, and we have felt that. So I think from our perspective, we always knew that we could get it done.
There was a lot less love for the management side, however, from musician supporters. Management negotiator Doug Kelly says now they face the task of turning that around.
There was a lot of energy around this labor dispute. There's no doubt about it, for and against on either side. And I think one of the things we have to do is harness that energy and say to those people, you had very strong opinions about what was going on. We hope you, A, you will attend concerts, and B, that you will contribute to the goodwill of the orchestra as it goes forward.
In a statement, Save Our Symphony Minnesota, a group supportive of the musicians, welcomed the settlements and in particular the change in board leadership. It said it, quote, looked forward to working with the musicians and the Minnesota Orchestral Association to ensure strong community involvement in the future direction and health of the organization. All sides admit there is a lot of hard work ahead, both on stage and off. Doug Kelly is hoping things go well, the economy improves, and audiences and the endowment grows in the next 3 years before they have to negotiate the next contract.
I hope that we won't have to go through this ever again.
There's work to do in the short term, too. In the next few days, there will be opening concerts to be arranged and tickets that have to be sold, and an entire subscription season to be arranged.
That's Ewan Kerr on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Lieutenant Governor Yvonne Prettner-Solon will not seek a second term this fall as the running mate of Governor Mark Dayton. Prettner-Solon says she will serve the remainder of her term and then begin a new phase in her life. Dayton now has a spot on the ticket to fill as he begins ramping up his re-election bid. Tim Pugmire reports.
Yvonne Prettner-Solon said she will retire from a 25-year career in public service when her current term ends in January. She began her political journey on the Duluth City Council. She later replaced her late husband, Sam Solon, in the Minnesota Senate, where she served 3 terms. Prettner-Solon, who is now 67, gave up her legislative seat when she ran with Mark Dayton in 2010, but she said she has no regrets about that decision.
You know, I knew that coming into the job that it was wide open. I knew that there wasn't a lot that described Lieutenant Governor. And I knew that it was an opportunity for me to focus on things that I'm passionate about.
In fact, the only duty of the Lieutenant Governor described in the state constitution is to fill out the term for a governor who can't. While the last Lieutenant Governor, Republican Carol Molnau, also served as State Transportation Commissioner, Prettner-Solon was largely invisible to the general public. She's been an advocate for senior citizens and people with disabilities and also chairs an advisory committee on state capital security. But Pretner Solon may be remembered more for a 2012 parachute jump to show support for military families than for the political partnership she forged with Dayton. In an interview last year, Pretner Solon said she rarely talked with the governor. Today, she clarified that they often communicate through memos and staff.
The governor and I talk when we need to, but we have communication staff, we have policy staff, we have, keep things going. We have numbers of memos that we send back and forth. And so the governor has his initiatives he's working on. I have my initiatives that I'm working on.
Dayton did not attend the announcement. He was traveling to Washington, D.C. for a National Governors Association Executive Committee meeting at the White House with President Obama. In a written statement, Dayton praised Pretner Solon as a courageous champion for the state. He said she's been key to achieving the administration's mission of building a better Minnesota. Dayton and Pretner Solon met privately Monday to discuss her decision. She said the governor did not try to influence that decision.
It was a process of weighing the pros and cons of whether I should stay or not stay. I told the governor yesterday. I think he was not startled. I think he understood.
One of the six Republican candidates for governor tried to quickly capitalize on the announcement with his own news conference. Former State Representative Marty Seifert of Marshall said he thinks Governor Dayton's first-term record has been harmful to rural Minnesota. He said Pretner Solon's departure is another symptom of that relationship.
Mark Dayton had a great asset in Yvonne Pretner Solon being a voice for rural Minnesota. It was totally ignored the last 3 years.
The last time a governor switched running mates was in 1994 when Republican Governor Arne Carlson successfully ran for a second term. Dayton has not yet commented on his search, but University of Minnesota political scientist Catherine Pearson said the governor will likely want the same kind of geographic balance that Pretner Solon provided in 2010.
Electorally, it was extremely helpful to have her on the ticket. After all, she was very, very popular as a state senator, and so that was very helpful. And that certainly is something that the governor will be looking for running for re-election, but it's not quite as critical as when he was running for an open seat.
Some names of potential replacements have surfaced, including Tony Sertich, a former DFL House Minority Leader who currently chairs the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board, and DFL Senator Katie Sieben of Newport. Sertich declined to comment on the speculation. Sieben did not return a phone message.
Tim Pugmire at the state capitol. Using tanning beds is known to increase people's risk of skin cancer, and that makes the results of a new survey from Minnesota teens especially alarming to the state's health officials. The state health department reports 3 in 10 high school girls in the state say they've tanned indoors in the last year. Half of those girls have done it 10 times or more. This is the first year the Minnesota Student Survey has asked 11th graders about their tanning habits. To find out why doctors are concerned, Tom Cran called Dr. Jerry Brewer. He's a dermatologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester.
So 34% of Minnesota's 11th grade girls say they've tanned indoors. Does that number surprise you?
Yeah, that is a little bit alarming, but unfortunately not all that surprising with some of the reports we're seeing where maybe 2 or 3 million people who tan regularly are teenagers.
What's the primary concern about tanning beds, and specifically when it comes to tanning beds versus lying out on the beach in the sun?
Yeah, that's a great question. Tanning beds, especially the high-pressure sun lamps, can increase the amount of UVA, which is the type of sunlight that is one of the primary causes of skin cancer, including melanoma, by 12 times the annual dose. So in other words, you might be getting more of an effect, up to 12 times more of a sun effect when you go to tanning beds versus laying on the beach. And in fact, it's been shown that just one session in the tanning bed increases your chances of melanoma by 20%.
One session. And we're seeing that half of those who have done it, according to this study, young people, have done it more than 10 times. So the multiple use, I imagine, just increases someone's chances by that much at least?
It does, yeah. And there are some startling statistics out there that if you've gone regularly like that, especially during the younger years and particularly before the age of 35, then your chances of melanoma can be 75% more likely.
Are there things we still don't know about the health effects of tanning beds?
There could potentially be. We're finding more and more out as the years go by. And it used to be that we didn't really know quite what the effects of tanning beds were, but these effects are now becoming more and more known. And in fact, one recent study that just came out this month suggests that women who are 40 and 60, who were kind of in that range back 20 to 30 years ago when tanning beds were first starting to come out and had that nice appeal, women in that age range now are getting melanoma over 2,000% more often than compared back in 1970.
I understand skin cancer rates, melanoma rates in general are rising overall. Can we link that to an increased use in tanning beds only?
There are many reasons why people get skin cancer, and sometimes we're born with genetic things that just make us a little bit more likely to develop skin cancer just because of the skin that we inherit from our mom and dad. But certainly there are other behavioral issues that increase our risks of developing skin cancer, and being outside without sunscreen is a big thing. Working outside for many years can really increase your chances of skin cancer, but tanning beds tend to be a big one. What we think is happening is it's this intense burst of sun rays that you get from a tanning bed not only increases your chances of skin cancer, but significantly increases the amount of decreases the amount of time, the lag time from the exposure to the development of skin cancer.
In the end, is there any safe way to use a tanning bed, maybe putting on sunscreen?
Yeah, that's a great question. And really, there isn't much of a safe way to use a tanning bed. And the reason why is because anytime your skin gets tan, that is a response from having what's called DNA damage to the skin. The damage to the DNA is caused by the ultraviolet radiation rays. And in response to that, your skin darkens up in a way to protect itself from future exposure. And so, in essence, having a tan means you've had damage to the DNA, and that damage is what ultimately leads to increased chances of skin cancer later on.
Dr. Jerry Brewer from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, a dermatologist who has studied the health effects of tanning beds. Thanks so much for your perspective on this, Dr. Brewer. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Tom Cran, last night on All Things Considered. Minnesota's primary care shortage is raising the profile of nurses who have earned advanced degrees in the field. These highly trained nurses are seen by some as a cost-effective way to extend routine medical care to underserved patients. The potential has persuaded the Twin Cities Foundation to invest $10 million in a University of Minnesota training program. The Benson Foundation says the goal is to supply the region with more nurses who have doctorate-level training in family medicine, geriatrics, and other specialties. Here's Lorna Benson.
Patients don't come to Allison Romstead. The 36-year-old traveling nurse goes to them.
Hi, Les. It's Allison, the nurse practitioner. That beautiful bride of yours here.
Hi, Ruth. Look who's here.
Ruth Peterson is still in her pajamas eating her toast, but she happily welcomes Romstead into her small assisted living apartment in Wyoming, Minnesota. The 83-year-old resident took a tumble recently, and Romstead is here to check on her bruised knee.
It's fine.
Is it? Any more falls lately?
No.
Romstead recently completed additional nursing studies and earned a doctorate degree on top of her master's degree. Nurses with doctoral degrees like Romstead may or may not make house calls, but they're trained to diagnose and treat conditions, prescribe drugs, and even lead a primary care practice with some physician oversight. As the aging population grows, these nurses are expected to play a bigger role in extending routine medical care to patients. And nursing schools are moving to beef up their graduate-level training from a 2-year master's program to a 3-year program that confers a DNP, a Doctor of Nursing Practice. Romstead returned to the University of Minnesota for the additional training a few years ago. She says it helped her move the nurses in her department to an electronic medical record system, also called an EMR.
Within our department, we historically were just doing paper notes, and a lot of our employees didn't even know what right-click meant. They were phenomenal nurse practitioners, but had no computer experience and had no idea how to operate an EMR.
A nurse who can harness the power of an electronic medical record can take better care of patients, says Mary Chesney, director of the U of M's Doctorate of Nursing Practice program. Chesney says those skills are especially important in today's healthcare environment, where there's a lot of focus on controlling costs and improving care, especially for expensive chronic conditions, such as diabetes and heart disease.
They're learning how to pull data from the record so that they can track trends. They can track before you implement a quality improvement program, and they can track patient outcomes after.
Chesney says research indicates that skilled use of EMRs can even improve the health of a community. Nurse practitioners can't do everything that primary care doctors can do. Some nurse practitioners estimate they do about 60% to 80% of what a family physician does for about half the pay. That potential payoff was appealing to the Benson Foundation. Executive Director Judy Dutcher says her organization considered giving scholarships to family practice physicians, but she says the foundation realized it could get many more nurses in the field.
We just felt that we would have a bigger impact through the dollars we could give in terms of educating these really well-qualified nurses, and it just came down to economics.
The Benson Foundation will provide $20,000 scholarships. That's enough to pay for about a year of training in the U of M's three-year DNP program. In exchange for the funding, the university has agreed to graduate an additional 500 advanced practice nurses over the next decade.
NPR health reporter Lorna Benson, no relation to the Benson Foundation. Developers have revealed design plans for a new 11-story office building to anchor the western edge of downtown Duluth. Dan Crocker reports.
The new building will serve as headquarters for the women's clothing retailer Maurice's, a chain of 900 stores that was founded in Duluth more than 80 years ago. The company expects to hit $1 billion in annual sales later this year and plans to expand its Duluth workforce from 425 to more than 600. Duluth Mayor Don Ness says the new tower exemplifies a growing sense of confidence and optimism in the city.
This project, I think, holds extraordinary symbolic importance to where Duluth is and that sense of optimism in our community.
The $70 million plus project includes an $8.5 million state grant that will help pay for a city-owned parking ramp. Duluth will kick in over $11 million for the ramp. The building is expected to be completed by December 2015. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
A St. Paul landmark for homeowners, contractors, and handymen is about to disappear. Seven Corners Hardware is closing its doors after more than 80 years in business. Tim Nelson stopped by, and he has this appreciation.
Step through the door at Seven Corners Hardware Store in St. Paul, and you are guaranteed to get more than you bargained for. Need a hammer, for instance?
We have over 300 hammers.
General Manager Dave Rudy is happy to show you.
We have brick and block masonry hammers, all the ball peens and cross peens and mauls, split head hammers for manufacturing processes, wood mallets, roofers hammers, drywall hammers, and claw hammers that start at bin 1 and end down here at bin 101.
Seven Corners owner Bill Walsh says the store his grandfather started in 1933 and his father expanded now has more than 50,000 items in stock. They range from tiny screws to table saw parts to a 5-foot-long pipe wrench.
We've held our own against the internet and catalog sales and so forth. We've built the business on our employees knowing their product line and having unique items.
But Walsh has decided to close Seven Corners and its catalog business, liquidate the stock, and sell off the real estate.
Basically, it's just I live in California with my family, and I have a lot of business interests out there in California and Nevada. And commuting back and forth here has just got to be a little much.
The store is also in a prime location, just a block from the Xcel Energy Center, and amid a bustling row of restaurants and bars that cater to people going to shows and games at the arena. Walsh says he has a deal with a real estate developer, but that he has a confidentiality agreement through the end of this month and can't talk about the plans. City officials in St. Paul say they've already been approached about building a hotel on the site, but say they can't say more than that. In the store, customers were already mourning the change as they stop by to pick up the odds and ends they need. Anthony Kling was putting in a special order for 100 pairs of tiny brass hinges for a new restaurant menu he was designing. He was also eyeing the racks of parts towering above him.
Pretty sad that this place is going, because there's not a lot of places like this where people who actually make things can get the stuff that they need to make stuff. And, you know, just being able to sort of make those visual connections with things that you're working on.
Or something you didn't know you were working on. That's what happens to Paul Cole, a volunteer from the nearby Science Museum of Minnesota, when he stops by Seven Corners.
The help here is all professional, and I just love coming in here. I didn't come in planning to buy a screw gun and an impact tool today, but here I am $300 later out of here. And that's just the way this place works.
Manager Pat Shimoda remembers one Saturday morning the phone rang. A guy had jacked up a house to move it, and it was slipping off the cribbing. He wanted to know if Seven Corners had something to stop it.
Your advice is to get out of the way.
And even though they didn't have something on hand, Shimoda says he's flattered that someone called to ask.
And having the depth of products with all the plumbing, electrical, all the different things, garden products, whatever else on it, so you could come in here and pretty much find anything you needed. People always said if you don't find it here, you probably don't need it.
But that won't be true anymore. A liquidation started today. It's expected to run about 16 weeks, and then Seven Corners will become a building project in its own right.
That is Tim Nelson there in St. Paul and on the NPR News Update. Thanks for coming along. I'm Phil Picardi. Minnesota's Thursday News right back here tomorrow. I'm on the Daily Circuit with Carrie Miller Thursday and Friday, so Big John Wanamaker will have the podcast for you.